Good afternoon. House Education Finance Committee will come to order. Thank you, everyone. We have a very full agenda, so we're going to want to get started today. And Representative Marquardt, if you'll go ahead and move to the testifier table to present your bill. And I know there's a couple of superintendents here with us. And while you are doing that, let's see, Representative Nornes, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes from our last meeting?
Yeah, they look exceptionally nice.
Very good. So Representative Nornes moves adoption of the minutes from March 16th, 2016. Any questions, comments? All right, all in favor of adopting the minutes from March 16th, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? All right, minutes are adopted. Thank you, Representative Nornes. And Representative Marquardt, please go ahead and present your bill, and I believe that we're going to hear House File 2721 and hold it over for possible inclusion.
Very good. Madam Chair, I'd make that motion, if that would be all right. And first of all, Madam Chair, a huge thank you for holding the hearing today while the superintendents are here, and very much appreciate that. Thank you very much. This bill that we have here, members, I have personally kind of been a part of or dealt with for probably 30 years. And what it does, it is a land transfer between DGF School District, which I teach at, and Moorhead School District, which was the first place I taught at. So I'm kind of bringing my career here together. Also, 1 year at Moorhead, 30-some years, and now at Dilworth, Glenn, and Felton. But it's a plan that they have worked very hard on over a number of years, but most recently it's finally come to fruition. And it will benefit the students, it will benefit the districts as far as future growth, and will benefit the communities, the cities, as far as future growth. And just in short, let me just give you what the problem was. Think about this as the city of Dilworth. And years ago, that was basically it, Dilworth School District. Moorhead is right here, and the school district came all the way around it except for one little part. So all the part on the eastern, all the new development on the eastern part of Dilworth is actually in the Moorhead School District. And now we have over 200 students probably in that area, 250 or something like that, that even though they're in the city of Dilworth, they have to open enroll to Dilworth, Glendon, Felton. And so the trick on all of this was, how do you work kind of a land transfer that doesn't cost the state any money, keeps the tax bases equal among the districts so there's no loss of land base, and then also have minimal or no impact on the property taxpayers, both agricultural and residential, when you switch things through. And these magicians here next to me were able to make that work. And so what this bill does, it allows the districts to come up with a plan to transfer this land and to adjust the boundaries. And it also says as the districts do that, they have to make sure that the plan keeps the tax bases equal. They have to have a public hearing before they adopt any final plan. When the plan is adopted, notices have to go out to all the property taxpayers affected. The county assessor, I think it is, or the county board has to be aware of all this for the property tax changes, and a report has to go to the Minnesota Department of Education. So all things are covered, but what this does basically is allows the district to come across with the plan. And I think in your package you also have resolutions of support from both the Moorhead School District and the DGF School District that was unanimously passed. So to talk about a little bit of the details, I have Dilworth, Glenn, Felton Superintendent Brian Tygeson here, and also Moorhead Superintendent Lynn Kobash. And so I really want to thank them because they have worked tirelessly on trying to put this all together so it worked within the parameters that I mentioned as far as little or no tax impact and everything else. So Madam Chair, if they could say a few words, and we'll then open it up for questions.
Very good. Before we start, Representative Fenton, do you have a question now, or would
I'll let him testify.
All right. Very good. Well, welcome, and we're glad that we could schedule this today so you didn't have to make an extra separate trip to St. Paul. I know it's a distance for you, so welcome. And if each of you would please just introduce yourselves for the record and then provide your testimony.
I'm Lynn Kovach, Superintendent of Moorhead Area Public Schools, and I want to thank you for hearing our information. As Representative Markwick said, this has been a long-term issue. Some of the records I have even go back 50 years. This has been something that has, as I've looked, every time there's either a new superintendent in Dilworth or in Moorhead, the issue really comes to fruition. So we were very excited to be able to work on this. We had a joint task force made up of one school board member from each school district, one city staff member from each city, and an administrator from each school district. So we really worked hard to try and look at a plan that was advantageous for both districts. The meetings were held over a course of 4 months, and we developed a plan to recommend to both school boards in consultation with Minnesota Department of Education, Clay County, and really work together because we had to work with the auditor regarding the lands. The parameters for the plan were that it was a win-win for each district, that there was minimal tax effects for either district, and I know my board was really very conscious of that. The realignment would really model the future growth plans for both cities. We worked together with their city to look at the growth plans. So the plan has been submitted to the board, and there are questions they've had that we're continuing to work on. But each school board unanimously passed a resolution in support of the boundary realignment legislation.
I'm Superintendent Brian Tigerson from Dilworth, Glynn, and Felton. The end result was is a plan that is really non-controversial because of the little to no tax impact that it has. So we have widespread support from populace in both school districts. We're transferring a lot of commercial property from the DGF school district into the Moorhead school district, and the advantage of that is not only the amount of capacity that's bringing in help the residents of the Moorhead, but all of that property qualifies under the border security. So that's what's helping not have the tax impact.
We have an issue with the microphone here. I'm not sure what's going on. And it's hard to hear you.
Madam Chair, I was in agricultural committee earlier in this room in the same problem. It's been all day long in this committee room, so I don't know if we're going to solve it or not. So
perhaps not. Okay. So we'll have Ms. Keynes talk to the sergeant. In the meantime, it doesn't appear to be isolated to one particular microphone, so I apologize. Please bear with us.
We're just announcing damage later, right?
And the problem magically disappeared. All right, welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good to be here.
All right, let's try again. Hopefully, it'll suspend. Thank you.
So the documents that we've submitted include the boundary map, so you can see how the two school districts. It's basically like putting two pieces of a puzzle together because we basically border from north to south all along between Moorhead and DGF. It's such a large portion of our student body that lives in this area of Dilworth. So the plan solves some of that issue. We also included the map showing what the plan is that we put together and the properties that are associated with the plan, including property within the city limits of Dilworth, and then property that is some rural, some commercial, that'll be transferred over to Moorhead. And it really aligns with those growth patterns because the city of Dilworth is growing to the east on the north side of Highway 10. The city of Moorhead is growing to the southeast. So it allows for that natural growth for both. We've also included the meeting minutes and the resolutions that were passed by both school boards.
Very well. Thank you both. We appreciate your testimony. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt and the members from the school district. How many students will be impacted with this boundary change, and what are the plans to help with that transition if they're indeed going to have to be changing schools and whatnot?
Actually,
Mr. Tagason?
Thank you. The students, about 80% of the students already go to DGF schools.
Okay.
So really, we do not anticipate any of the students transferring between school districts. This is, for many of them, they are within a few blocks of their building.
Ms. Kovash?
We had heard from a couple parents that actually live there that attend Morehead schools. We will continue, they will be able to open enroll, and we will continue to transport them.
Right.
No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Dabney.
I wonder if the microphone will work.
We'll see.
I'm not sure whether to direct this to you, Madam Chair, or to Representative Marquardt. I've got no quibble with this bill. These folks seem to play well in the same sandbox together, and if they want to readjust lines, you know, kind of who am I to say? But I am aware that, at least here in the metro area, there are some other boundary questions that are not near as civil, not near as cooperative, if they were to get mixed in with this, that could prove problematic for any number of people.
Yes, it would.
So I guess the question maybe is about how do you, Madam Chair, keep this as a clean proposal and keep things that are not at the same stage of development off? Because I don't think those things should go forward unless they're at this sort of level.
Yeah, well, I think you raise a good point, Representative Dabney, and I'll just also just clarify with our nonpartisan staff here that this bill is specific to these two school districts, and they wouldn't create any kind of a precedent or policy that would extend to other districts who are perhaps not having quite as an amicable discussion about boundaries. But if I could just call in Mr. Strom to clarify and confirm.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dabney. Yes, the way the bill is drafted is specific to the two school districts. The general procedure that's in statute is one that's referred to as detachment and annexation, and that's driven by the individual property owners, not the districts, when that process is used. But the specific bill in front of you is all essentially special legislation as a local approval clause that requires both of the jurisdictions to approve it before it's effective.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Mr. Strom, particularly with the local approval clause requirement, that would also allay any germaneness questions. This doesn't open a back door for someone to come forward with an amendment and arguing that it's germane because this bill either is, I assume it's being held over?
It is.
Okay. Because this bill is in a larger bill. Am I correct?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I'm not sure that I would say that. I'm not an expert on germaneness, but in our usual procedure, things related to education finance are germane to the education finance bill. So if an omnibus bill were to appear from this committee, I'm not sure that the local approval clause would provide much on one section in that bill, would provide much direction as to which way the committee or the floor should go with that in terms of germaneness.
I guess, Madam Chair, Mr. Trump, I know what I meant. I just didn't quite say it. But the local provided any attempts to amend had that same local approval clause, it would limit the ability for hijinks, not on the floor, but in the communities.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, if two other districts were to craft a similar proposal, mimic this language, and it had a local approval, it would require both of their board's authority prior to that section being effective.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have concerns.
Valid question. Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Seltzer.
Thank you very much, and I don't want to, and thank you for bringing that up because I represent one of the districts, yes, involved. But and I don't want to take away from this bill. I support this bill, and this is obviously a well-thought-out mutually beneficial situation, but I will just comment that I believe, and I, having been first party to this, that it, right now in law it does require that both school boards would approve any changing of boundaries. So that is in law right now, is my understanding. I guess I'm asking for confirmation.
I believe so too, but Mr. Strom, if you could.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, yes, the existing law would require the district losing the property to have a say in it. So in your area with the Hopkins and Edina situation, the Hopkins School District essentially needs to consent to the property moving to the neighboring district under the detachment and annexation procedure.
So Representative Seltzer.
So thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Strom. And so I don't believe that this, though, thank you for inquiring, would have any effect on the particular situation in my area.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, woman, sorry. We've had discussions on ag land taxes, and I heard the superintendents discuss not a lot of change to commercial properties, but could you just address the fact or the situation of possible switches of ag land between the districts, and would there be a tax implication to the farmers up there?
Mr. Tigerson?
Yes, Madam Chair. There is very little. There is some ag land that is, if you look at the map, over along 336. Now, most of that is also designated commercial, but there is some ag that would be moving over to Morehead School District. That property would see about a $5 increase per acre. The rest, any of that is commercial, won't see any effect. So we don't have any of the land moving from the DGF School District to the Morehead School District does not include any students transferring as far as in that ag area. So we have probably, I believe, three parcels that would be associated with a $5 increase. And so we'll go through that process locally in discussions.
And Ms. Goldfash, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Well, if my understanding was right, also, Madam Chair, that as far as almost all the ag land, it was just a matter of pennies an acre.
For any of the ag land that is not transferring, there is little to no. It's like a penny on an acre.
Okay.
So it's just ag land that would transfer between the two school districts.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, well, Representative Anderson, anything further? All right. Any other questions from committee members? All right, seeing any final comments, Representative Marquardt?
Oh, Madam Chair, just thank you so much for hearing the bill. And as you can hear, it's somewhat complex putting things together, so I want to thank Tim Strom and all the staff and the department that really weighed in on this bill. So thank you, members, very much.
Thank you, and I want to congratulate the two superintendents. These are not easy issues to address, and it looks like you're approaching this in a very civil, thoughtful manner. We appreciate that. So with that, Representative Marquardt renews his motion that House File 2721 be laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. And we thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
All right. I think what I'd like to do is we've got a couple of different topics here. One is the Early Learning Scholarship Report, which was on the agenda yesterday, but we didn't get to it because the floor session went long. And then I wanted to hear some I'd like to hear about innovative programs that are going on in Minnesota or in other schools across the country to help improve educational attainment, and specifically for our children of color, and that we've been very focused on the achievement gap. And so we've got a couple of presenters on that too. If it's all right, I think what I'll do is I'll hear the Early Learning Scholarship Report and from the department, if Ms. Barnbridge is here. And then we've got a couple of testifiers after you on the Early Learning Scholarship Report. And then we'll kind of finish up our business from yesterday, and then we'll move to those the other testifiers on the sort of innovative programs. But I do want to finish everything today by 2:30. Every time we add something to the next day, we fall farther behind. So we'll try to stay on track. So, Right, so Assistant Commissioner and Ms. Barnage, I appreciate you both being here so much. And whoever wants to lead off testimony, we welcome it. Just please introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Wayne Nguyen. I'm an Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. Ms. Barnage actually will be doing the presentation, but I'm just here to support her.
Very well. Thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner. We appreciate you being here. Ms. Barnage.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lisa Barnage, and I'm the supervisor for the Early Learning Scholarship Program at the Minnesota Department of Education. Today, we're going to give a quick high-level overview of a legislative report that we submitted back in January to your committee, as well as the committee in the Senate. Just a high-level, kind of quick synopsis of the Early Learning Scholarship Program and its expansion since fiscal year 2013. We did start the program in 2013 with a $2 million appropriation, and at that time, scholarships were $4,000 per scholarship, and we served approximately 507 children. Today, in fiscal year 2016, we're at $44.1 million. The cap has been raised to $7,500 per scholarship, and we are statewide. And as of December 31st, 2015, we were at 6,112 children receiving early learning scholarships, and we are projecting approximately 8,200 children by the end of June. Next year, we will continue to be statewide at almost $60 million, and we're projecting approximately 9,500 children receiving an early learning scholarship next year. The legislative report was in statute is for us to look at three different components of the Early Learning Scholarship Program. The first was the appropriate scholarship amount. The second is the efficiency and effectiveness of the administration of the program. And lastly, we were asked to look at the impact of the program on kindergarten readiness. NDE did evaluate all three components of this evaluation over the last two fiscal years. We did hire two different evaluators to look at different components. Stanford Research International, or SRI International, was hired to look at the kindergarten readiness impacts of the scholarship program, and Management Analysis and Development Division at MMB was hired to look at what an appropriate scholarship amount might be, as well as the efficiency and effectiveness of the administration of the program. SRI, again, looking at the impact of school readiness from children receiving scholarships, were asked approximately two different questions about how we should be thinking about the impact of children's school readiness. The first was, how did the scholarship recipients attending 3- and 4-star rated programs' outcomes compare to children in 1- and 2-star rated programs? And the second was, what were the school readiness outcomes at the completion of pre-kindergarten year for scholarship recipients in 3- and 4-star rated programs? The concept behind these two questions is the idea that the scholarship program would increase children's access to high-quality programs, and high-quality programs have impacts on children's outcomes. So the questions that we're really asking in this evaluation is, did attending a high-quality program impact children's readiness for school? We did a pre- and a post-assessment of children in 3- and 4-star rated programs compared to children in 1- and 2-star rated programs. The children were 4 years of age before entering kindergarten, and we did access our comparison sample from the Parent Aware Validation Study that was being ran concurrently to our study and being done by ChildTrends. ChildTrends was the subcontractor for SRI, so they were doing the assessments on both sets of children. So the outcomes that we were able to see when we compared children in the 3- and 4-star rated programs compared to those in the 1- and 2-star rated programs was that children did have better outcomes on two measures of early literacy from their comparison group. We also saw that children had a higher anxiety than the children in the comparison group, but this effect size was relatively small, and the children's levels were not of clinical concern. Additionally, we did not find any other statistical significance on the seven other measures that we measured the children on, which included early math, social competence, attention, persistence, and executive functioning. Another analysis that we did with the data that we had was actually to look at children's growth within each group. So looking at your fall scores to your spring scores, and were children growing over that time relative to a norm sample, what we consider the average child in the country. What we did find was that all children did have better scores in the spring than in the fall. And specifically, the children attending the 3- and 4-star rated programs had better scores on 6 of our 9 measures. And children in the 1- and 2-star rated programs had better scores on 3 of the 9 measures. It is important to also note, though, that the comparison groups did have higher post-test or spring scores than the 3- and 4-star rated group. Just to note that although we are improving achievement, we're still not closing that gap. There was another analysis that we were able to conduct with this data between Pathway 1 and Pathway 2 early learning scholarships and the outcomes of children attending 3- and 4-star rated programs in either a Pathway 1 or a Pathway 2 scholarship. We did find that there was no statistical difference between outcomes for those children. However, the mean pretest scores for the Pathway 1 children were higher than the pretest scores than the Pathway 2 children. This indicates that the Pathway 2 children were likely more at risk than the children in the Pathway 1 scholarships. So that the children that are being served with Pathway 2 scholarships have more factors that could be contributing to their readiness. So the main conclusions from the first portion of our evaluation is that all children benefit from high-quality early childhood programs. Early learning scholarships are a financial mechanism to help families access high-quality early childhood programming. And children in low incomes are making gains, but we are still not catching up to our higher-income children when in high-quality care. Sorry, I'm going to try to catch up on my notes as well. The second part of the evaluation that we looked at was what would be an appropriate scholarship amount. The current statute requires that we review the child care market rate survey from Department of Human Services, as well as we hired MAD to look at a sample of invoices for scholarships over a 12-month period during the fiscal year 14 and 15, or between the fiscal years of 2014 and 2015, to determine what are the actual amounts that we are expending on scholarships. The Department of Human Services is required to do a study every other year. It is a survey of child care providers throughout the state requesting what the rates are that they charge. They do cluster the information they receive from the providers into 4 different clusters based on rates. It's counties that have similar types of rates. For example, perhaps in greater Minnesota, there will be counties that have similar rates on providers, where other areas might have higher or lower rates. The metro area is cluster 4, and then 1, 2, and 3 that you see on this slide are... There's a list of those counties that we could get for you if you're interested, but just the lowest to the highest of the rates.
And Ms. Bainbridge, just to interrupt you for a second, is that for children ages 3 and 4 years old for comparable information, or is that all ages?
Actually, Madam Chair, I actually can't answer that question. Sorry. In this case, they do also cluster the price ranges. So you have an infant and toddler price range and a preschool class price range and a school-age care price range. So yes, it is all, but they do separate those price ranges. In this slide, I'm actually looking at the preschool, which is normally 3- and 4-year-olds.
Thank you.
So what we can see across the state, at the 50th percentile of rates, which would mean that at this rate, there's approximately 50% of the providers above and 50% below, we can range in a family child care provider from $5,200 a year to $78,000. And for a child care center, it can be between $6,500 to almost $13,000.
And sorry, and Representative Newton, you had a question, I think,
yes,
on this.
And I'm just curious on the vouchers or scholarships. Is that for the full year? Does that pay for the daycare and education for the full year, or is it only for the school year?
Ms. Bainbridge.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, the early learning scholarships are for a 12-month period. So whenever the child picks up a scholarship, the $7,500 can cover expenses up to 12 months.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Barnage.
Thank you. And then if we look at the 75th percentile, those rates range between $7,000 and $13,000 for child care centers, or $14,000, and then for between $5,700 and $8,800 for family child care providers. So we can see that this is a good sample of where the price ranges are throughout the state compared to the $7,500. When MAD did an analysis of the actual expenditures we're seeing with early learning scholarships, this here is the mean and the median. The statewide mean or average scholarship is being spent is at $2,439. In the metro, it's actually lower at $2,300, and in the greater Minnesota, it's slightly higher at $2,500. We also looked at those expenditures by different types of programs. Here you can see that our highest program expenditures are for Head Start, and actually our lowest expenditures are for child care centers.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just need some clarification, and perhaps you can answer this, but if I look at what the annual cost is for the various child care settings, and then you look at what the mean scholarship expenditure is, it's significantly less. Do you know why?
Ms. Barnett.
Madam Chair, there's several different things I think that could be playing in. We know for sure that the scholarships are being blended and braided with other funding streams. They could be being used with child care assistance, school readiness aid, Head Start. It's depending on what other funding streams the child might be using. And so at this point in time, two things that are also playing in these means is, at this point in time, the scholarship amount was for $5,000 because of the recent change. And then additionally, this is very early in implementation. So this is how programs were using it in the first couple years. It is possible that as the cap changes and as the programs and families get more normalized to having an early learning scholarship, that this expenditure rate could also change.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. And I just, and maybe it's later on in the presentation, or maybe it's too detailed information, but the average child who gets a scholarship, and I understand that it was could have been braided with other funding streams, et cetera, but are they, you know, the point is to get them into a quality setting for the majority of the year. Do we know how long our average child is in a quality preschool or daycare setting per year? Does that make sense?
Ms. Barnage.
Madam Chair, Representative, it does make sense. And at this point in time, and especially when we did this, we didn't have a statewide data system that could help us with that information. We did launch a system, and it will start to include payments in July. And I think we will definitely be able to have that better, rich data. But at this point in time, what we do know is that the children, actually back in fiscal year 14 and 15, over 80% of the children are in 3- and 4-star rated programs. So we do know they're accessing high-quality programs. Some of those programs can be a Head Start program and a school-based program usually run about 9 months out of the year. Child care centers and family child care usually run year-round. But some programs were also using it as an additional programming beyond what the regular program does. For example, Head Start, because they do run school year, they also tried to use the funds to add summer programming to fill that summer gap for children so they could use their Head Start funding for the 9 months and then use the scholarship for the 3 months to make a full year for a child.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Quam also had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You touched on the point that there are multiple ways of getting funding, streams of funding, and you know, that's not surprising in education. What is the, so that the is the scholarship the last? In other words, all the other ones come first. The scholarship makes it whole, and that allows for more scholarships to go out. Is that the correct interpretation?
Ms. Barnage.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would say that that would be the correct interpretation. I'm not sure with every funding stream, so I want to maybe temper that a little bit. For sure, with child care assistance, we actually work with child care assistance, and we try to inform counties and providers that we request that you first charge services to child care assistance, and then the scholarship should be used to fill any gaps, co-pays, times that the scholarship or the CCAP won't pay for. Additionally, with Head Start and school districts, Head Starts are required to pay their federal amount each year per child, so those funds should be used as first as well. And then with school districts, they are really using these funds to help add additional days, lengthening their program, and using their school readiness aid with that.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Ms. Barnage, please continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to kind of highlight these slides, the differences between what the actual cost market rate is to what we're actually expending per scholarship, the department has been looking at the mixed delivery settings, and we do believe that even though the current mean is below $7,500, we do know that 13% of those children actually did use the full maximum scholarship, so there is a need for a higher scholarship amount. Therefore, we propose that the $7,500, or we would be saying in this evaluation that the $7,500 is an appropriate scholarship amount. It allows for flexibility to award the scholarships in increments that children need, while also using the funding in an efficient way to serve as many children as we can. So that was kind of the conclusion for the appropriate scholarship amount portion of our evaluation. So then the last part of our evaluation that we were required to look at was the efficiency and the effectiveness of the administration of the program. The evaluation began in fiscal year 2014, so we were actually just in a beginning part of the implementation of our program. It was a 12-month evaluation, and I must apologize. We started in 2015. It was calendar year 2014, but in the fall of 2015, fiscal year 2015. So it was our second year of implementation. It was about 12 months of collecting information from our regional administrators, families, providers, and other stakeholders. So what we found was there were some great findings in the evaluation, but we had also, in that 12-month period, made a lot of progress in implementing and improving the implementation of the program. So many of the findings we have either begun to address or had actually addressed by the end of the evaluation. Mostly the evaluation looked at how well we do outreach to families, our communications with regional administrators, with providers, with families, as well as stakeholders. The scholarship materials that we use, including the application, it also includes the invoicing that we use and how we allow providers to invoice, as well as data and the coordination with Parent Aware, as that's a very important part of our scholarship program, since children can only attend programs that are Parent Aware rated. Some of the key strengths that the evaluation found was that we are reaching a very diverse family with many risk factors. Providers report that they have a good relationship with our regional administrators. It also indicated that 95% of parents with either Pathway 1 or Pathway 2 indicated that their children are attending the program of their choice, and that MDE was able to make some improvements throughout the period, including reducing the application size, providing additional training for regional administrators and Pathway 2 programs, and we launched our Early Learning Scholarship Administrative System. To highlight kind of the diversity that we are able to reach with the Early Learning Scholarships, this blue line is actually the percentage of children receiving an Early Learning Scholarship by race, ethnicity, and the gray line is actually the statewide population. So, for example, we are serving higher proportions of minority children than our state demographics in almost all areas of race, ethnicity. We're also serving children with a variety of different primary languages. This shows how children are being served by a variety of different programs by their language: English, Spanish, Somali, and Hmong. There was also other, but I guess it didn't make the chart. So the scholarship application was one area that we did work diligently over a couple of years to help improve the application process. We were able to decrease the application from 10 pages to 5 pages and able to help families fill out that better when we give better training to our regional administrators, more technical assistance on filling that out. We're also able to improve the accessibility of the scholarship application by by translating it into multiple languages and ensuring that it is available in a timely manner for families to fill out. Additionally, per statute, beginning July 1st, Pathway 2 school districts and Head Starts will be using their own applications for early learning scholarship recipients. There are a few fields that we are requiring they ensure that they have on their application to make sure they meet the requirements of the scholarship program. And as I noted, giving clearer direction on how to complete the income eligibility has helped improve families' ability to fill out the application. One thing we did want to show is this is how there are two different options of filling out your income on the application. The first is the normal income. It's really the second. You prove your income by submitting some tax forms or your pay stubs. The first is actually showing your participation in one of the statutory programs in the program, or in the statute, I'm sorry, which is child care assistance, MFIP, free and reduced lunch. There's five of them. Foster care, and there may be one more. But if families can prove they're participating in one of those programs, they don't have to submit any income. And so what this slide shows us is that 74% of the applicants actually use option one and do not need to submit income verification with their application. So although it is an area we continue to work on to make it easier for families to verify their income, a majority of families are able to use the easier process of just submitting verification of participation in something like CCAP. So the report also highlighted a need to have accurate and real-time data for the administration of the scholarship program.
And Ms. Barney-Jell, Representative Hartas, did you have a question about that last point?
I do.
All right, Representative Hartas.
Thank you. I see that you've got the three bars there, and I guess my question would be with regard to accountability. I could imagine that somebody who may have been eligible for a program and using that as a qualification, circumstances may have changed along the way in terms of maybe having a dream or an opportunity fulfilled, or they have the income capacity to pay for some of this. So for your own internal control and the best use of the money and that it's being allocated to the best, most eligible individuals, are you reevaluating that, or are you going to use that methodology?
Ms. Barnage.
Madam Chair, Representative Hurtis, the statute does allow and automatically qualifies children for income eligibility if they are participating in one of these programs. The one thing that we do require is a recent verification. So for CCAP, you requalify right now every 6 months. So if you provide us a documentation that you're in participating in CCAP, we verify that it is within that time frame. Free and reduced lunch is actually a 12-month period. So we do kind of, we adhere to the requirements of those programs on when they have to be reauthorized or recertified for their eligibility. The statute also does require that once a child receives an early learning scholarship, they continue to receive an early learning scholarship until they enter kindergarten. So we do not recertify a child's eligibility once they do qualify.
All right. Representative Hurtis, are you satisfied?
Yes.
Thank you. All right. So continue, Ms. Barnage.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just going back to the need to have timely and accurate data for the Early Learning Scholarship Program, the department did launch the Early Learning Scholarship Administrative System. We call it ELSA. We launched in January of 2015. We have been working very hard this last year to actually have the system make payments as of July 1st, as is a requirement in statute. Once we have the payments in the system, we'll have all the children who are receiving early learning scholarships in the system, as well as how much we are paying out per scholarship per child. Additionally, the one thing we're excited about with the launch of ELSA is that it has allowed us to create some other efficiencies in the scholarship program. For example, we are able to, sorry, I'd written it down, allow children to move between Pathway 1 and Pathway 2 early learning scholarships within a 12-month period, giving funding is still available due to this real-time data where we can track how much a child has currently spent on their current scholarship, therefore how much money could they still receive if they were to be able to access a different scholarship. So we're very excited about our ability to move that into implementation this year. That also helps us to save money and ensure that we're using those funds, fully using our funds. And the data system also helps us to coordinate better with DHS and their data that they collect on their program side. So in conclusion, I know we only had 15 minutes, I'm not sure where we're at, but we do have reason to be proud of the gains the children are making in the Early Learning Scholarship Program, but we also know that we have significant work to still be done. We need to continue to be ensuring that Minnesota children are entering kindergarten ready for school. The scholarship program and Parent Aware are both relative new and have made improvements in the early learning stage, or in the early stages. They continue to adapt and find ways to best serve needs of their children and our families in early care and education programs. While scholarships are reaching children from diverse backgrounds, we do believe that there are additional risk factors that may be underrepresented, and additional strategies should be used to receive or to reach out to our most vulnerable children. The Early Learning Scholarships has made tremendous gains in developing an infrastructure to implement scholarships. And continued enhancements will only help us to streamline and make our program better. Thank you.
Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I forgot your name, but you triggered memories of an argument with your boss between me and her. I've done a lot of studying on at-risk children, and the factors that you're looking at are not anywhere near what most studies say we should be looking at. And you may know that I've had bills in, and to get you to do that, they've never gotten through here. Are you looking into even the most common one is, of course, Robert Andes. But you can go to the Search Institute here. There's all sorts of different factors that most everyone that's an expert in this field says should be looked at that we're not looking at. Have you had time or an incentive to look into those factors that everyone other than this program seems to think we should be looking at.
Ms. Barnett.
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory. But this year, we actually did require a set-aside for all of our regional administrators for children who are homeless. So we have been serving a higher proportion of children who are homeless this year. Additionally, we have been working diligently with foster care and helping to improve our application process. Foster care is actually an eligibility without income for children. And because CCAP doesn't actually help, doesn't allow children on foster care to receive CCAP, it is a great resource for families who may want to take on foster care children but can't afford the care, and to help make sure that those children who are in transient settings are given the best quality education, high quality education they can in the early years. So we are working to continue to improve reaching out to some of those vulnerable populations that we know are out there.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the most highly recognized factors is concentrated poverty, not poverty. But with concentrated poverty often comes a lot of the real stress factor. Robert Anda does not use poverty as, in fact, he spent an hour and a half one time talking to me about why poverty, it was on other things too, but why poverty is not a factor. So those pockets exist not in the inner cities, but in various places around the state. Are you considering looking into that, since a lot of experts think that's one of the most important factors we should take into account? Are you considering moving that into the list of factors you go by?
Ms. Barnett.
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, we have, since we were unable to go statewide originally with our formula or with the Early Learning Scholarship Program, we've actually used the poverty concentration model that K-12 uses to determine the formula. So we do have, in all 4 years of the program, made the funding available based on poverty concentration of areas.
Representative Mallory.
Madam Chair, unless things have changed, it was poverty concentration by huge areas, which is the opposite of what, and I think it. I think you're going by the same thing I was saying, and when I'd ask experts, they would say, no, not that's not concentrated poverty. Concentrated poverty is a little pocket, not a countywide thing. For instance, I remember talking to a teacher from Todd County who said that on a countywide basis, they were at one time either the highest or second in poverty concentration for a county, but that if you looked at all the factors, they were very low on stress factors versus positive factors. So that if you're not looking at little pockets, then you're not going at what the experts say are the way to do that. And in the past, you were not doing that, unless it's changed in the last 9 to 10 months or something like that.
Ms. Barnett?
Madam Chair, Representative Mallory, you would be correct. We have not changed our formula since the beginning. Thank you.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is some really great information that you guys, that you've provided us with. Do you have information also? Have you followed any of these children up into higher grades to see how their performance is compared to other children who didn't have this opportunity?
Ms. Varnage.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is a great question. And I first was going to say, yes, we have the Early Childhood Longitudinal Data System. That just launched in January, and actually with the launching of ELSA, we now are able to assign unique identifiers on the children. So unfortunately, the first two cohorts of children, we wouldn't have that data on them, but going forward, we will be able to do that, and definitely are looking at our ability to do that.
Okay. Representative Fenton.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'll look forward to seeing that. Thank you so much.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Barnage, I'm going to try to tie two of your slides together. The first one being school readiness outcomes by pathway. If you look at the bottom of that, you say pathway 2 children were likely more at risk than children using pathway 1 scholarships, which is interesting that the public schools and Head Starts are serving more of the at-risk students or children. But then I go over, and then I go to program chart 6, program type by primary language. And that is that one of the risk factors you're talking about? Because there again I see that it's more the public schools and the Head Starts that are serving non-English speaking children.
Ms. Barnett.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, that is a correlation you could draw. The original conclusion about their pre- and post-test scores are specifically based on the fact that their pre-test scores were lower, but it was not looking so much why were their pre-test scores lower, because they were a higher demographic. But as you're pointing out in this slide, we can also see that the children attending programs that most likely have a Pathway 2 scholarship are serving children with a higher percentage of English, not their home language.
Madam Chair, Ms. Barnes, thank you. My reading comprehension is not what it should be. You refocused me on the pretest, which is actually makes it more powerful of a point. Then you'd also the findings also indicated on comparison of school readiness outcomes by quality ratings. Numbering the slides in the future might help all of us.
Sorry.
But it would cut my question time in half. No significant difference between the two groups of 1 and 2-star rated program attending children versus 3 and 4, including on early math. And I'm wondering if you're the person to ask about, or if there's someone else, does the parent aware rating system sufficiently include standards around early numeracy? The research is increasingly the kids can do a whole lot more than we'd given them credit for in developmentally appropriate ways, and we're probably not hitting them, which is going to show up in the achievement gap, that we're not responding to the achievement gap on early numeracy and related issues. Can you help with that?
Ms. Barnage.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney, I will first qualify what I say is that Department of Human Services does run the Parent Aware Rated program, but the Department of Education does work in concert with them. And I do know that in the indicators for the Parent Aware Rated ratings is that the programs use the early learning standards, or the Minnesota's in Early Childhood Indicators of Progress, which does include math. We do, though, at the Department of Education, we're currently in the revision of our early learning standards through the Race to the Top grant, and math is one of the areas which we're looking at. We actually also have received a National Governors Association grant to specifically look at early learning, early math skills as it relates to our early learning standards. So, to your question of whether or not it's strong enough, I think we're looking at that right now ourselves and how we can improve our standards for what we believe children should know and be able to do. And the revisions to those standards will be included in any revisions to the parent-aware indicators as well.
Very informative. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Barnard.
Thank you. Representative Erickson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And members, I'm just going to ask that after Representative Erickson, we have two other testifiers on this topic. And in the two-ish range, I would like to move to our other testifiers, not on this topic. So if we could, I know we have lots of questions, and perhaps we can bring the department back another day as well, but just to try to keep us on track. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Barnage, how secure is your data? Who has access to it? And are you the only one who manages it, or does Health and Human Services also manage and have access to this data? Would you comment on that?
Ms. Barnett.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I'll try to best answer that question. just because there was a couple things coming in at once. How well do we
secure
our data? Our data system is held here at the Department of Education. It's overseen by Minute and has the same security as all other data systems at the Department of Education, our MARS data, our State Student Identifier data. We do...
Access.
Thank you. The people that have access to our data at the department is actually, besides the Minute employees, would be about two staff on my team. Additionally, the regional administrators access the data as they input the data, as well as school districts and Head Starts with Pathway 2 funds. Their access to the data is to actually put in who the children are. And then school districts access the data as well to assign unique identifiers to the children.
So basically the school districts, Madam Chair, manage the data. Is that correct? Or does that happen before?
Ms. Barnage.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I believe the answer is that they input the data, so they do manage the data.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. And I would ask, if there's any other questions that come, if you would not go too far away.
Thank you.
But we appreciate very much your testimony and your report. And I would like to call Erica Moss with Parent Aware down. And then Ms. Sanford, if you would be kind of on deck. All right, so there are some questions in that around Parent Aware and other things, so I thought it would be great to have you come and provide some perspective as well on this report. So just please identify yourselves for the record, and Ms. Moss, welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Erica Moss, I'm the Executive Director of Parent Aware for School Readiness, and by way of reminder, our organization is an independent nonprofit organization. We don't own or operate the Parent Aware ratings. We advocate for their success and have worked on the ratings and scholarships for a long time, but the programs themselves are Department of Human Services and Education work together to administer the programs. I wanted to talk today about how things are going from our perspective. We have a long history of involvement in both the scholarships and the ratings. A quick refresher, we started in 2006, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation raised $20 million in private money and piloted the scholarships in Parent Aware. Since then, the programs have been scaled by state government, and we're really excited about the progress. From a big picture perspective, over the last 10 years, particularly during the last 5 years, the number of kids accessing quality programs who otherwise wouldn't have has increased, and this has happened in two ways, members. Parent Aware, the rating system itself, is in place. It's in place statewide. The number of rated programs is growing consistently over time, and that means that more providers in Minnesota are using best practices that prepare kids for kindergarten, and more parents, regardless of whether they're shopping with public subsidies or paying out of pocket, can find providers using best practices. And the second way that access has grown is that, the legislature has invested significantly in recent years in supporting low-income children accessing quality programs. The largest share of investment going to scholarships. You just heard from the department that this year about 8,200 children will benefit from scholarships. Just a couple of leading indicators from the data. Since 2012, which was when the statewide scale-up of Parent Aware began, the number of rated programs has increased about fivefold, nearing about 2,500 rated programs around the state. That number is growing every week. Providers are volunteering to be rated. And the largest growth in recent months and years really has come from the types of providers that weren't as easily reached early on. That would be non-accredited child care centers, licensed family child care homes around the state. Further, parents are using ratings, as evidenced by the tremendous success of ParentAware.org, a child care search website that was developed as a public-private partnership and launched last year. Within the first full year of availability of that website, the site had 1 million page views. Parents are using the site. They spend meaningful amounts of time on the site. They return to the site. And our market research tells us that increasingly parents report they are using the ratings when they're making a choice for their child, and they're telling others about the ratings and asking providers about the ratings. So we do see parents engaging with the ratings, and they're increasingly aware of them. The providers that go through ParentAware overwhelmingly report positive impressions of the program, and regardless of whether they participate in the full rating process or the so-called accelerated pathway to rating, they report making direct changes to their program as a result of their participation. For example, in both pathways, a majority of providers report that they are more intentional about how activities and learning environments impact children's lives. That's a really great kind of direct report from providers about how they're using the rating. And then you just heard that scholarships are connecting a diverse, high-risk group of children to ParentAware-rated programs. And most importantly, the ParentAware evaluation, which I'll talk a little bit more about later in my testimony, tells us that children in rated programs are making significant gains on kindergarten readiness measures, and that low-income children are making greater gains than their higher-income counterparts on measures of early literacy and executive function. So this is a great start. We're really excited about where we are. You just had a long conversation about scholarships, so I'll be brief. From our perspective, the job of scholarships is that they're a financing mechanism to connect children to programs. Scholarships are working well and are connecting at-risk children to the best programs Minnesota currently has to offer. Though we have questions about how well scholarships are functioning for children who don't already have access to a program. So are they working to expand the number of children with access, or are they mostly deepening access for children who already have it? Both are goals of the program. Both are worthy endeavors. But we'd really like to see scholarships be able to do the kinds of connections that Hennepin County is doing, children in foster care, finding children who have access to no programming currently and connecting them to the full access that they need to be ready for school. Just by way of comparison, in the pilot with uncapped scholarships, 57% of participating children before they had their scholarship were in unlicensed or informal care setting. So they were in programs that weren't even meeting basic state health and safety, and then they were moved into 3- and 4-star rated programs with their scholarship. That's the kind of work we'd like to see these scholarships be able to do as well. And so our answer would be to allow flexibility in amounts above the cap. We also have raised concerns before this committee before about scholarship portability. We've had conversations. I think there's openness to working on this. But just so the committee is aware, there's not great portability currently with the so-called Pathway 2 scholarships. And I can just give an example of how this might impact a family. So if a homeless family connects to a scholarship at the child, at the child care that's in their shelter, that family, that child will necessarily move before they start kindergarten. If that scholarship is a Pathway 2 scholarship, to go somewhere and use the remaining balance, that family would have to find another Pathway 2 site with an available opening. This is in contrast to the way it would work if that child had a Pathway 1 scholarship. If that child had a Pathway 1 scholarship and needed to move or make a transition, the remaining balance of that scholarship would follow the child to the next program. And so that family would have many more options, many more possibilities for finding a place for that child to be. So we would like to continue to work on issues related to portability and Pathway 2. We think it's really important for scholarships working and for getting the outcomes that we seek for children. Another, briefly, I think there could also be better transparency for families. I think it's really important for families in the Pathway 2 process and the Pathway 1 process to understand what their scholarship entitles them to. So, for example, it's important for families to understand that if they have the option of receiving a scholarship for younger siblings in that family if the kids can be in the same program together. That impacts a family's choice if they're aware that that is the case. And so we'd like to make sure that there's transparency so that families, when they're choosing, they don't inadvertently choose a program that's only serves preschoolers if there's a 2-year-old in the family and then aren't able to make a change that would stabilize more children in that family and make life easier on the parents who could avoid 2 drop-offs in the morning. So those are a couple of issues. They're really in the weeds, but I think they're really important to getting this to work in the way that it's intended. I know there's not much time, Madam Chair. I did provide a handout detailing findings from the Parent Aware evaluation. I think this evaluation works together well with the evaluation that you just saw from scholarships, in particular the comparison of child outcomes in 1- and 2-star rated programs and 3- and 4-star rated programs. The Parent Aware evaluation goes much deeper and provides more analysis and data around both observed quality and child outcomes in different levels of rated programs, so through the star levels, but also among different program types. So looking across the types of programs that are included in the accelerated pathway, for instance, Head Start, school-based pre-K, accredited childcare, and also looking at those ratings, those programs that go through the full process. I'd be happy to talk more about that, but in the interest of time, I'll leave it at the handout. I'd be really happy to come back or to answer members' questions as they come up. And just the final thing I just wanted to make a note about, I've gotten several questions on a bipartisan, bicameral basis about the fact that at the end of this fiscal year, families will no longer be able to use their scholarship at a 1- or 2-star rated program. And I just wanted to provide a little bit of where the research or what I see in the evaluations about that. So I think we see that scholarships are increasingly an important incentive, in particular among the groups of child care providers that weren't signing up early on, licensed family child care providers. So scholarships are an incentive for them. That's important because if we can get more programs in the rating system, they're using best practices, and that helps all the kids that attend those programs. We're also seeing that quality is not static. Of the last group of programs that came through the rating process, those that were getting a second rating, 80% of them moved up. So it's not as though a 1-star program, they're stuck. They're a 1-star forever. The idea is, and it appears that providers are deepening their use of best practices and are making changes and are moving up the star levels. Kids at all star levels are making significant and important gains. While we see kids making the strongest gains in 3- and 4-star rated programs, kids in all star levels are making gains. And I think the last point is maybe the most important. There's been an uneven amount of time available to providers around the state based on the rollout of Parent Aware. So many greater Minnesota counties only first had the opportunity to seek a rating in 2015. And so just given what we know about how providers are using the rating system and progressing through it, we would support pushing the move up to 3- and 4-stars out a few years. Certainly... It will make sense at some point. I'm just not sure it makes sense right now in all areas of the state, in particular given the uneven rollout of Parent Aware. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Seltzer, do you have a question you need to ask?
I do. Thank you, but I'll make it brief.
Okay, thank you.
First of all, it's very exciting. It's just the improvement that our children are experiencing, so I won't go on about that. But I do have a question as we... It's wonderful that our kids are making gains, you know, and it's a new program, but and you can't expect right away to close that gap.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering, and I apologize, I probably should have looked at the Parent Aware standards before coming here today, but one thing that we know is that parents and guardians are the first and best teachers of our children, and you know, both Representative Luna and I have sponsored legislation around that. I am wondering, is there any, and I understand it's kind of hard, you know, in a home care situation, but are there any standards in the Parent Aware system that provides at least guidance for parents in best practices at home?
Ms. Moss.
Madam Chair, Representative Seltzer, thanks for that question. Parent Aware does include family engagement standards and indicators, and so those would incorporate things like sharing formative assessment results with parents, providers, you know, how looking at how providers give information to families about what happened with their child during the day, things like that, how providers connect parents to other resources that are available in the community, early childhood family education, other support services, things like that. So there are family engagement practices embedded. And I think the expectation of a high-quality provider would be that those adults who are interacting with children during the day have deep understanding of the child in the context of their family, their culture, the practices that they have at home, what the parent preferences are for that child, and that they are in communication with the family members. You know, the great thing about childcare is you see the parents twice, right? You see them at drop-off and pick-up, and so using those opportunities as they're available to have relationships with families and conversations about what's happening with the child during the day, those kinds of things.
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Representative Loon. And I would just encourage you to continue on that path.
Okay, great. I had Representative Anderson who said he had a short question. And then if we can, what I'd like to do, though, is if you have a really quick question for Ms. Moss, otherwise we're going to move to Ms. Sanford. Okay, Representative Anderson.
I'll talk very quickly, Madam Chair. You talked about the new programs around the state. It didn't mention any specific areas. I was hoping you'd say they're all in greater Minnesota. Could you give us any idea of the spread of the programs around the state?
It's getting better.
Ms. Moss. Yeah.
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't have up-to-date information on that. I think the department is, I'm seeing my colleague from the Department of Human Services nodding. They're doing a specific report on parent aware in greater Minnesota. But there is a large and growing share of programs in greater Minnesota that are being rated, and there are some tremendous partnerships happening around the state with local organizations that are doing really, really great work to engage, provide training, those kinds of things.
Yeah, and that's a good question. I will follow up with the departments and ask them to send whatever data they have for us on that. Thank you. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be very brief. When you do the ratings, are you rating the facility like the kinder care, and are you looking at the individual teachers within the facility to determine their ability as a teacher and their education level?
Ms. Moss.
Madam Chair, there are standards related to teacher training and education built into the rating system. So that includes degree level, also training that happens on an ongoing basis. There are requirements for training on an ongoing basis for teachers in different settings. And at the 3- and 4-star level, there's an observation, and an independent observer goes to the program and observes the interactions between the teachers and children, and rates them on a research-based scale for that. And that happens in 3- and 4-star rated programs that are seeking, centers that are seeking a 3- or 4-star rating, 3- or 4-star rating that aren't already accredited.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Sanford.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Moss. We appreciate it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's wonderful to see so much green for a woman named after a county in Ireland, so happy St. Patrick's Day. My name is Claire Sanford, and I represent, I'm the Government Relations Chair for the Minnesota Child Care Association, which represents about 250 child care centers across greater Minnesota and in the metro. And I'm also the Director of Government Relations at New Horizon Academy. I'd like to thank everyone for this opportunity to speak about how early learning scholarships are working in the community and the interaction of scholarships and child care assistance, which I know does not go through this committee, but I think is a committee that cares a lot about how scholarships work. It's important to recognize the interaction between those two programs. I'm glad to follow Ms. Moss and the MDE report, and I'd first like to thank you for providing real access to early learning programs for families who didn't have that before the scholarships. We are thrilled from the report to see that we are reaching diverse communities. And one of our members who's been a director in a low-income area for over 30 years always says, scholarships are like Christmas every day when families are able to get that access. And they say, I never thought my kids would be able to have something like this. So it is making a real impact out in the community. And this is just the beginning of very positive results for children in our state who need high-quality care and will be kindergarten ready. The report also shows places providers can make improvements in, which is good because we're all in this together and we're all in it for quality, continuous improvement. But when we look at the scholarship report, a few things do stand out to us as providers. One, and we've talked a lot about this today, we know there are two pathways, pathway one, pathway two. In pathway one, families choose their provider, and in pathway two, the money goes directly to a provider, and then they can distribute it to families in that program. And for transparency's sake, many of our members are receiving both Pathway 1 and Pathway 2 funds to help families. The surprise for us in the report is that more than half, 59% of children, are being served through Pathway 2, which does provide less parent choice, as we've talked about, and also can systemically concentrate poverty. And I'd be happy to answer questions about how it does that. I'm not going to go into it right now in the interest of time. I know, Representative Mullery, you were speaking earlier about concentrations of poverty, so I wanted to mention that. Pathway 2 was intended to build capacity in certain communities, but as we look to increase scholarship investment going forward, we encourage the legislature to put those investments into Pathway 1 scholarships so they can be driven by parent choice. It's our job as providers to be responsive to the needs of families in our communities and outcomes for children, and as long as parents are choosing a quality setting, the state shouldn't and probably doesn't care where they go, and neither do we. We just want everyone to have the choice to go to a high-quality setting, and every part of the system serves specific needs. We're also surprised that with last year's new investment, we still weren't serving many new families with scholarships, but it was really good to hear from MDE today that the projection is now 8,200 by the end of the year, which is higher than I've heard in the past, so that's great, and I understand it's a moving target. And we need more, everyone knows. Families continually contact us for scholarships when there is no more money available. The demand for high-quality programs is high. But again, we encourage any new investments to go through Pathway 1s to promote family choice. And I also realize, as I said, we're going to discuss child care assistance and how it works with scholarships, and child care assistance flows through HHS and not this committee, but the interaction is critical. If we want scholarships to work, we have to pay attention to how the child care assistance program is working as well. For example, we talked earlier about the braiding of funding streams, and Representative Seltzer, you pointed out that even with the top cap for a four-star rated program, $7,500 is not enough to afford the full cost, particularly of a full-day, full-year program for families. So they are braiding and blending funds. And just at my own organization at New Horizon Academy, 58% of children who use early learning scholarships are also using child care assistance or CCAP funding. And they're using those scholarships to bridge gaps in CCAP funding. And that's why you see a low average spend for, as was brought up earlier, for the scholarships, because CCAP is billed first, and then anything that isn't covered can be charged to scholarships to fill the holes. CCAP is the primary early childhood delivery system for children 0 to 3, so infants and toddlers, when care is most expensive and most difficult to find for families. And it's also a funding system that supports 3 to 5-year-olds along with scholarships and school-age children. So we want these systems to work together, because any child with a solid foundation, birth and on, is going to do best. The federal changes, let me back up. You've probably heard about federal changes. There was a reauthorization of the Child Care and Development Block Grant at the federal level, and this is the legislative session where Minnesota is going to have to deal with putting a lot of the new regulations into place. Congressman John Klein from our 2nd District led the reforms to that, and they're important and well-researched and were done over many years and are going to make good things happen for kids and families all across the country. In an anomaly of bipartisanship, it passed the U.S. Congress, only one no vote in the Senate, and no, that vote was not from any of our current presidential candidates. So if Washington can come to the conclusion that this is what's right for kids and families in a bipartisan way, we hope we can get these reforms in Minnesota as well. The new requirements include things like unannounced visits of programs serving young children to increase health and safety and stabilizing funding for families. The reauthorized law puts equal emphasis now on the experience and development of children, not just as a work support to get families to work. And part of this new requirement is that the federal government is requiring that we do something about our CCAP reimbursement rates and keep them high enough so low-income families have real choice among providers who are willing to accept that, and also that they can choose high-quality programs. And this is where the interaction with scholarships is so critical. If we don't go forward to increase CCAP reimbursement rates, early learning scholarships will become less powerful over time, because as the gap grows between what CCAP covers and doesn't cover, more scholarship dollars will be going to fill those holes. And as Ms. Moss talked about earlier, we want more children to get access. We don't want two programs to be funding the same children. If we can improve one program so that another one, like early learning scholarships, can really do what it's supposed to do and expand access to new children. The governor's supplemental budget recommends the 50th percentile of current market rates. Doesn't go as far as the federal recommendations, but it would go a long way to helping the interaction with scholarships.
Right, Ms.
So,
Sanford,
in closing,
thank you.
I'm closing. In closing, scholarships are wonderful. Thank you to this committee, and we would like more. But particularly if we care about scholarships working, and we do, that child care assistance piece can't be ignored. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Stothlin, I see you sitting. I don't have you on the list, and I have two other folks that I need to have testify today.
I can be very brief, Madam Chair, and I was not planning on testifying, but I do need to correct some information that was presented by Ms. Hanford. I can be very quick, and I can certainly come back another time, but I do think it was inaccurate to say that parents, that Pathway 2 is not a parent choice model. The report showed that 95% of the parents the report showed that 95% of parents in scholarships got the program that they wanted to access. Parent Aware or Pathway 2 programs do need to show they have a waiting list and that they are serving those programs. And so I just need to correct that misunderstanding that was just presented by Claire Sanford, and I'm happy to come back, and I'm happy to bring some other people in Head Start programs and school readiness programs to talk about the Pathway 2 children they are serving.
And Ms. Dozen, just introduce yourself for the record, some favorite comments.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Valerie Dozlin. I represent the Minnesota Community Ed Association and the Minnesota Head Start Association.
All right. Thank you. So you got your points on the record. We will be coming back to this topic at a later time. But, again, I really want to get to the other part of today's testimony today. So thank you, Ms. Sanford. Appreciate your time and your testimony today. All right. So now switching topics, members, and, again, I apologize for the last day has thrown us off and a little bit compressed, but I would like to call up Lowell Matthews from the Foundation for Excellence in Education. And again, I am always looking for innovative programs that are going on, whether it's in one of our schools in Minnesota or another state, that we can learn from in terms of how we try to increase and improve and enhance our educational attainment of our students, and particularly those students we've identified as being in the achievement gap in Minnesota. So Mr. Matthews is here to present some information to us, and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. My name is Lowell Matthews. I'm with the Foundation for Excellence in Education, and I'm the Policy Director for College and Career Readiness. You've heard a little bit of the testimony on the front end of the pipeline, and I want to provide you some information on what other states are doing on the back end. Today I want to talk about some incentive programs in a couple of different states. First off, I want to talk about the industry certification incentive, as well as the economic security report, and then an advanced placement international baccalaureate incentive that Florida has adopted. Not to go Shirley Temple on you, but in a prior life, I was the staff director, professional staff director of the Florida Legislature Senate Committee on Education. And we were confronted with many of the same issues that are confronting you now. And essentially, they boiled down into five basic facts. And the first fact was that not all of our kids were going to college. It was a recognition that some of them were not going. Now, some of that may have been due to lack of preparation, some of that may have been due to choice, lack of interest, but as you can see from this slide here up on the screen, from a federal perspective, we have about 70% or so of our parents and students believe their student is going to go to a four-year institution, and only 42% actually did. I'm going to skip over the rest of those slides and head to some Minnesota-specific data. In Minnesota, your class of 2014, about 69% of your students ended up entering college, your high school graduates, after the fall following their graduation. And unfortunately, when we talk to employers, employers for the most part don't value the high school diploma in of itself to a great degree. In many situations, they consider it like Confederate money, interesting to hold. The South may rise again, but in terms of telling them exactly what a student is prepared to do, if they enter their particular facility, not as informative. And in this slide, you can see about 18,000 students are potentially entering your workforce with only a high school diploma. This doesn't include the number of students that do not graduate from high school. If you look at the next slide, you'll see what that looks like in terms of your various subgroups. And this is all data from your Minnesota Office of Higher Education, so I won't spend a lot of time on it, but you can see that the percentage, the college-going rate varies significantly depending on what subgroup you are, and most importantly, whether you're a free and reduced price lunch student or not. The second fact that we were confronted with is that not all of our students were completing college. And so in this slide, you're going to see some Minnesota data, again, from the Office of Higher Education, which compares your 150%, which in this case is a six-year grad rate for your state universities, six-year grad rate for your University of Minnesota system, and then a three-year rate for your state colleges. And the numbers up there at the top are the ones that did not complete within the 150% of time for that cohort. This slide kind of brings it down to the granular level that we just talked about in terms of your achievement gap. And as you can see, the blue one is your state colleges, your four-year institutions. This would include your public and private. And you can see the various completion rates for those students based on the subgroup that they come from. The third fact that we were confronted with is that our students were also telling us some alarming things. This data is from a McKinsey & Company survey, Voice of the Graduate, in 2013, which was a survey of four-year graduates in which 30% of those surveyed indicated they were unprepared for the workforce, mostly due to technical reasons. 45%, interestingly enough, told us they were overqualified for their position. And in this situation, overqualification meant they were in a position that did not require a four-year degree. 48% were not working in their chosen field, and not surprisingly, more than half would have chosen a different field or college if they could take a mulligan. The fourth fact that we were confronted with was something that you all are intimately familiar with, and that is the changing nature of workforce demand. Nationally, 65% of the job openings, this is the Georgetown University Center on Education and Workforce report, are going to require some type of post-secondary education. Manpower, which I'm sure you're familiar with, does the annual talent survey. Again, skilled trades, the hardest jobs to fill for the second, for the sixth consecutive year. And then the Advanced Manufacturing Institute has also indicated that there's going to be about 2 million unfilled jobs in the next decade based on lack of qualified applicants. So what does that look like in terms of Minnesota, again, from the Georgetown University Center? About 36% of your projected jobs are going to be post-secondary education short of a bachelor's degree, 27% a bachelor's degree, 11% a master's degree or higher. And then if you focus all the way onto the far right, you see the high school diploma or less, which is 26%. Unfortunately, when you add up the number of students that are not graduating from high school, that are graduating from high school but not entering into any type of post-secondary education, in effect, you're oversupplying that 26% of projected jobs. And then the fifth one I didn't prepare a slide for, but career and technical education, which I'm going to talk about briefly here. One of the issues that we were confronting when we were in Florida was that it had been significantly marginalized, and I think that's true in most states, both from a policy perspective, in terms of the emphasis on college, and also from a incentive, either no incentive for pursuing a career in technical education, an industry certification, or the wrong incentive. I recall when we were in Florida, we were talking about occupational points, achievement points, whereas our employers wanted to know whether an individual was qualified or not, whether they were partially qualified. And so what we did is we created an industry certification incentive in Florida. And this was the brainchild of a superintendent of schools in Okaloosa County who decided he wanted to take what he was doing in his school district and replicate it statewide. The incentive was performance funded, so a school earns an incentive, earns financial incentive when a student earns a qualifying industry certification. The industry certification has to be tied to workforce demand. And then several years later, we also added a teacher bonus for each teacher whose student earned a qualifying industry certification. So why did we pick industry certifications or industry recognized credentials? Because they're used by employers to validate, to verify whether an applicant is qualified for a job or qualified with little training to do the job. And the whole pipeline seems to benefit from the industry certification process. The students can earn an industry certification that's tied to workforce demand. It's a meaningful work credential that's recognized. It's portable. So if they leave the state, it's not a situation where it's a state licensure and it's not valid in Wisconsin. If you have an American Welding Society certification, that goes from Wisconsin to Minnesota to Iowa, whatever state you are in. And it gives students a choice. When they graduate from high school, the industry certification, they can decide whether to go immediately into the workforce because we know it's tied to a job that's actually in demand, or they can decide to augment or stack their skills. Many of these industry certifications are stacked at the post-secondary level, so the student has an option of pursuing post-secondary education. And most importantly, it's the student's choice. We're not, this isn't tracking. The teachers and schools benefit because the bonus funding is tied to the industry certification. So this is add-on FTE. Employers, as we've already talked about, have a benefit. And then, of course, the state can realize economic growth through the attraction of industry because of the skilled workforce. Funding depends on the state. There are three states that currently incentivize industry certifications. Florida provides funding through its funding formula, and depending on the type of industry certification earned, determines what type of funding the student would generate. So, for example, if the student's industry certification did not articulate into college credit or had lower wages into demand, then it would generate only $403 based on 2015-2016 budget negotiations. If they generated an industry certification that was tied to college credit, it could be 0.2, which is 832, or it could go all the way up to 1 FTE. And the one example of that in Florida is the FAA private pilot's license. A student can actually earn in high school a private pilot's license recognized by the FAA, and that student would have generated an additional $4,000 to the school. The teacher bonuses are likewise tiered, $50 and $25, although the legislature is in the process, the Florida legislature is in the process of raising those. I want to talk briefly about the other two states, Kansas and Wisconsin. Wisconsin adopted theirs in December of 2013. They put $3 million, this is a budget committee, so I'll talk numbers here. they put $3 million into their program. It was oversubscribed in the first year. So there is demand here. They do theirs on $1,000 per student. More than 3,400 students earned the industry certification, so they actually had to prorate. Kansas adopted theirs in 2012. They put $1.5 million in. They burst their cap in 2 years, but because of budget cuts, they've actually had to reduce their appropriations overall. And then I wanted to provide you some data, and I know you guys are pressed for time, so if I'm going too fast, then you know, feel free to interrupt me, Madam Chair. So we wanted to show what the data looks like when the program is actually in operation. And this is Florida data, since Florida's got the longest running program. In 2007-2008, before the industry certification incentive was adopted, about 2% of Florida high school students were enrolled in courses that led to an industry certification. As you can see, 2014-2015, now almost 39% of all Florida high school students are enrolled in courses that lead to an industry certification. And because we didn't want it to just be a participation issue, we also tracked how many students were actually earning industry certifications. Again, in 2007-2008, before the incentive was created, 803 students statewide earned an industry certification, and that was actually almost all of those certifications were earned in the district from which the superintendent had created this program. So most of the rest of the state was not participating. And then you can see in 14-15, 6 or 7 years later, 58,576 students are now earning industry certifications annually in Florida. So the Florida legislature had asked the Department of Education to also look at what type of students were participating in these type of programs. I don't know if that music's telling me to shut up or not. So the department studied those, and I don't know if you participated in career and technical education when you were a student in high school, but if you did, most of your compatriots were overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly white. But as you look at the CAPE participants, and CAPE here is the Career and Professional Academy, as well as career and themed courses. These are the courses that lead to an industry certification. You can see that in Florida, the participation among the subgroups largely mirrors the high school population at large. So participants, female, 46%, non-participants, 49%, African-Americans, 20%, or participants, 23%. You get the idea. One of the unique things about Florida is that they rework the industry certifications into the articulation agreements. So recall that 58,000 students who earned the industry certifications in 2014-2015, roughly 28,500 of those students, or roughly half of them, simultaneously earned college credit by virtue of earning the industry certification. So not only was the student getting a valuable work credential, but they were also earning college credit simultaneously. And this was not done through concurrent enrollment, so these students did not have to apply to college in order for them to earn these credits. And then the number, the tuition cost, is about $6.3 million in potential savings. That number needs to be taken in the context that Florida has one of the lowest tuition rates in the country, if not the lowest. This slide kind of gives you one example, and if you look down at the really small italicized down at the bottom, that actually shows you all of the Florida industry certifications that articulate into college credit. And this one is the MSSC Certified Production Technician, and this industry certification, if the student earned it, would entitle them to 9 hours of credit towards the an AAS or AS degree in manufacturing technology, just to give you a general idea of how that that works. Kansas is the other state that we have some data from in terms of the performance, and you can see 548 students earned industry credentials in the year before the incentive was adopted, 1,670 in 14-15, so obviously a success in Kansas. And like I said, Wisconsin, your yellow and green neighbors to the east, they only have 1 year's worth of data, and they burst their cap the first year. So recall that I had talked about the McKinsey survey and regarding the number of students who were four-year graduates who were not working in their chosen field, almost half of them, overqualified for their position and would choose differently. The McKinsey survey also went a little deeper. It asked the students, you know, how did you get there? What were you looking at when you decided to choose that particular degree program or certification? And if you look at the top three bars, they pretty much tell the story that too many of our students aren't looking at valid data that is available out there about the success of these programs. 37% didn't look at the starting salary when choosing their degree or college. 39% did not look at the employment rates. And more astonishingly, almost half did not look at the grad rates. that led us to create a what we call an economic security report in Florida. It's also called the same thing in Arkansas, and Kentucky has recently agreed to do it as well. And what they try to do here is to synthesize a little bit of that information into a digestible two-page summary that's given to each eighth grader and then every student annually thereafter, which gives them links to a larger report on wages and employment prospects by degree and by institution. And many states actually already collect this data. Unfortunately, it's not actually distributed to parents and students. So, for example, Minnesota has the graduate employment outcomes data tool, but it's not clear that students can actually are seeing this data when making these type of choices. And why is that important, and why do we start in the eighth grade? Because you want to actually influence their course taking in the middle school level, so that if they decide, you know what, I want to be an engineer or I want to be something else, that they'll actually start changing their course-taking patterns early enough to actually make it happen. And like I said, Minnesota collects the data, so this is the type of thing that should not be a fiscal other than the printing of the two-page summary. Here's the example of Arkansas's, and again, this is an example. This isn't something that, you know, Minnesota has to copy carte blanche. But what they try to do is to synthesize in a digestible format to parents and students in a language they understand. Here are the first year earnings based on the certificate level that you would potentially produce. Here are some selected areas, some average first year earnings. I would also recommend if Minnesota were interested in doing something like this that you also split it out on the AAS and AS degree, because you will see some rather interesting wage conclusions that show that those things are of significant benefit to the student. Arkansas also splits it out on the second page by the top 15 degrees by first year earnings, and then the bottom 10 in terms of earnings. And they also do it for a five-year breakdown. Now, it doesn't mean that the student has to choose this. This is only information to the student. What they decide to do with it, what the parents decide to do with it, is their choice. But this is a means of getting that information into the hands of students. And then the last thing I want to talk about, since I know we're pressed for time.
Yes, and Mr. Lowe, I will unfortunately have to ask you to wrap here pretty quickly. We're over time, and I know there's another meeting coming into this room shortly.
Sure. So I just want to show you these two slides, because Florida does the same thing with its AP incentive for every student who earns a qualifying score. Also Utah and Arkansas, and you can see from 1999 up until 2014 what type of success Florida has. And then the last slide I want to show you is the success that Florida has with respect to its African American and Hispanic populations as well. So I live in Rochester, Minnesota, so I'd be happy to come back and answer any questions or provide additional information to the committee would need. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. And I'm glad to hear that, because I have many questions. I have a feeling other committee members do as well. So I promise you we will have you back very soon. And I must apologize to Mr. Santa and those with the Santa Foundation, who were all prepared to do a great presentation for us, but we are going to be hearing from them. I understand you're out of the country next week, so it'll be the week after we will have you come and present. We were very excited to hear from you as well. So, again, I apologize. Every once in a while, the schedule, we have to make adjustments here, but we will hear from you, I promise. So, with that, members, thank you very much for your attention and trying to shorten your questions. We'll get these folks back again so we can cover this a little more thoroughly. But thank you, and committee is adjourned.